You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got Tebow. He shattered the mold and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, the editor at 538. With me in the studio to my right, I know that our readers are always, our listeners, excuse me, are always really interested in where we're sitting. So let me just say that
it's weird.
Cade Fagan, our senior Equal Pay Day columnist.
Oh, good. I'll get that to you later today, Chad.
And ESPNW columnist. Double column duties,
yeah.
Is here and is sitting in a different seat. Kate, how do you feel that Neil
I feel
has
awful.
Taken
oh,
your
boy.
Seat?
Wow.
I walked in and Neil was in my seat, and I felt, because I had been in Bristol for a couple weeks remotely, that Neil felt as if he had the right to sit wherever he wanted, including my seat, and that I had lost some sort of power.
Wow, Kate. Wow.
That wow is expressed by Neil, the stat man Payne, who will soon be excommunicated from the show. Neil,
I feel that
yourself.
Might be true, yeah. So, you know, when I sat down, it wasn't clear to me immediately whether you were going to be here in person or remotely.
Oh, blame the victim.
So,
wow.
Blame the victim.
You know, it's just trying to justify my actions here.
And then when you saw me come into the studio?
Yeah, you rushed right past me. I thought you were going to stop.
That chivalry really kept you right in your seat.
Right.
It did, yeah. And I thought, Kate's going to want this seat. And then she just blew right past me and sat in the other seat. And I was like, I guess it's fine. But now that we're on the air in front of God and everyone, I guess it's not fine.
It's not fine. And I was passive aggressive about it before. And now I'm being aggressive about it.
Just regular aggressive.
Yeah.
Keep that energy going on today's show. I want to see conflict, etc.
We're embracing debate.
Mm-hmm. On today's show, we will talk about both NCAA.
Feng shui debate.
Yes.
Guys, I redesigned my living room, and I'm a believer in feng shui. That's
oh,
a
I'm a
note.
Believer, too.
That's a side note.
I clearly am not.
It's statistically provable.
Is it really?
No.
Ooh, I would read 538 on feng shui. Assigned, Neil.
Oh, man.
On today's show, which is about sports, not interior design, we're going to talk about both NCAA tournaments, the women's and then the men's. UConn streak. Poof.
Poof.
Perhaps one of the more...
unwatchable
ugly games that we've seen in a while with the men's final as well, and then we will talk about rest in the NBA. Is LeBron right to think the league is overreacting? Is the league right to think that it's a problem for the players? Is this a new thing, an old thing, a tired thing, etc.?
All of the above.
Oh, we don't even have to have the segment now.
Whoa. We want to tease people for the end of the show.
I'm emboldened by sitting in this seat, Kate.
I know.
I've realized now.
Are you going to offer more hot takes?
I'm
going to
offer so many hot takes, and you're going to offer so many tepid, half-hedged,
lukewarm.
Statistical, lukewarm
Ooh.
Takes.
I like the Freaky Friday aspect of this, of this show. All right, let's get to the UConn women, all of the women's NCAA tournament. Let's start with the UConn women, who lost to Mississippi State in an overtime thriller. On Friday night, Morgan William, the diminutive Mississippi State guard, was sort of lights out throughout the game. Not quite as good as her Baylor performance, but still quite good. Shot the game-winning shot to end UConn's streak of 865 days, 111 wins in a row. Kate, we spent a lot of time on the show talking about the sort of
flawed model. The 538 had.
I wasn't going to go there first.
Wait, I thought it was flawed. So
it
I'm
was
curious about this.
I know.
I thought it was flawed too low. But now what do
you
think?
Yeah, I'm saying
you were
just – like the model obviously
– Was it too high? But now is it too high? Was it too high? I guess there's
well,
no
– No,
I mean you guys had it as like 50-50, like fluctuating between 40%, 55%.
But that's to win the whole tournament.
I know. I know it sounded like I was like your flawed model, but I was calling out the fact that I called it flawed, so, and now perhaps it was justified.
Mississippi State had a 13% chance to beat UConn during that game. And UConn, I think at that point was up to, what was it, 74 something percent overall to win the tournament.
Yes.
So
I was going to say 111 wins.
No. Yeah. So the the chances that Mississippi State won were slim coming in. This is the same Mississippi State team that had been trounced by UConn, essentially same team that had been trounced by UConn in last year's tournament, Sweet 16, by 60 points. So, Kate, I'm interested in hearing from you about you've spoken at length on the show about the sort of the aura of UConn and how intimidating that is, and how that can't be summed up in a model, and that's what we were talking about the last week and the week before. And I'm curious, now that you've seen the counterfactual proven, does it make you question that approach?
Well, the counterfactual was proven, but if you dig into Mississippi State and their preparation over the last year after that 60-point loss, it actually does prove the aura of UConn, okay? Because after their win, a bunch of the players articulated something very similar, and one of them put it the absolute best. They were like, last year in the Sweet 16, when we were playing UConn, we were scared. We were scared to go get our ball during warmups if it rolled over half court. And we carried that mentality throughout the game. Now, after that loss, throughout the course of the season, they like hung, like, I'm not a banner, but like a memento reminding them of the 60-point loss, and told themselves stories all year long that they're just another team with another just wearing jerseys playing hoops. And so, yes, sometimes we articulated the UConn aura as being like impenetrable. That was obviously flawed, and hopefully every time we spoke about it, we mentioned that it wasn't impenetrable. But Mississippi State ran up against it, got killed by 60, and spent a year trying to break down that mentality within their own selves so that when they stepped on the court against UConn in the Final Four, that would not be a hurdle they would have to overcome.
And we should note that, so there was that sort of psychological and motivational aspect to it, but then, and that perhaps fed into the sort of components of the game, basically, and that's where you do start to see some of this show up in the stats a little more, where Mississippi State had 16 more shooting opportunities than UConn did because of turnovers and rebounds. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of thing where, you know, it's one thing to talk about bulletin board material, for example, but eventually that has to get translated into play, and Mississippi State figured out how to do that in a way that, you know, every team, I'm sure, was gunning for UConn and hadn't figured out how to do that.
Yeah, and maybe the way in which the tide turned, if you compare to that game that we were talking about from last year versus the upset this year, the way that it kind of changed the most was on defense and on rebounding, in which, you know, they got out-rebounded by, I think it was 15 in the game last year, and they ended up out-rebounding UConn by 6 in this game, and they also, drastically reduced UConn's shooting percentage in the game, and that enforced a lot more turnovers also, I should say. So kind of add up all of those things. Those are all sort of, in addition to talent and whatnot, those are like effort and preparation type of statistics, where if you sort of single-handedly focus on building a game plan against a particular team, and, you know, I guess every team in women's basketball is building a game plan in some way, shape, or form if they feel like they need to face UConn and they're standing in their way. But in this particular instance, yeah, it was kind of clear that things had changed so much, and they had changed in the ways that sort of seem to be more based on preparation and just, you know, sort of overall, like, having a focus on an opponent.
I think we had so frequently asked the question, not just on this podcast, though I'm sure we alluded to it, but throughout, like, sports media, of, like, is UConn bad for the women's game? Now, I think what we saw in that semifinal was that they weren't bad for the women's game, because we didn't see UConn play terribly. We saw a team that spent a year teaching itself to believe. And I know it sounds odd because, like, they didn't go on and win the title. South Carolina won the title. But they focused so much on that 60-point loss to UConn and facing UConn again that they played to a level. And then we saw a moment with Morgan William that was also born of, like, a tragedy in her own life. And all of these moments in sports that fuel sports awesomeness. And then we were given, because UConn held fast to this standard of play and this style of play and this level of play, that we were given a moment, like, in women's sports where, like, a team matched them. And then not only did they match them for 39 minutes and, you know, 59 seconds, then they also had to deliver this, like, one of the most memorable shots in college basketball history in order to beat the greatest team of all time. And so, like, I think ultimately you land in a place where, like, UConn could never have been bad for the women's game because, like, look at what it delivered.
And to your point, Kate, which you speak about how narratives are built within women's sports, because Morgan Williams hit that shot against, and because it was against UConn, when she didn't play in the fourth quarter in the final against South Carolina, it became a narrative.
Yeah.
And so, and the same within the actual game against UConn between Mississippi State and UConn, where there was a flagrant foul. Was it a flagrant foul? Was it not a flagrant foul? That was the kind of thing that people do hot takes about, you know, the next day on various shows on ESPN or other networks. And it turned out that Connecticut didn't win the game. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that's obsessed over. And so in order to build the stakes that you need for the hot takes to matter or to be thought of in the first place, you need a giant, perhaps, to fight against and to push against.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about South Carolina's win in the final, which came against a very tired Mississippi State team after beating Baylor and UConn, by our models' estimations, at least the two best teams in the tournament. We talk often, Kate, about whether when a team wins a championship, whether that style filters down within the rest of the game. Do you see some of that within South Carolina, or is UConn still the hegemon even though they're now vanquished?
They're still the standard bearer. I don't think, like, all of a sudden South Carolina has some sort of recipe. To me, and I would be interested if 538 has ever looked at this. I don't know if you can analyze it, but when a team pulls off an upset, whatever you label, like, an upset that qualifies, where they're maybe more than 8-point underdogs, or maybe it's even more, how frequently do they then win the next game, if you look at the tournament? Because, like, I've played in the tournament where we pulled off an upset, we beat Stanford, and the next game, it, no matter how much you told yourself, like, that wasn't it, that wasn't it, that wasn't it, you do just get depleted of something. Because it took a lot of effort to focus so much on, like, getting that one win. And so, to me, it's less about what can we learn now from, like, the way South Carolina has done it. Because unless you're going to go around in a program, there's not a ton of Dawn Staleys out there who carry the kind of cachet she carries among recruits, former gold medalists. Like, that's what South Carolina had. And then also were a part of an amazing moment. Because I know, and even though they wouldn't admit it, Dawn Staley and that staff is sitting on the sidelines in Dallas, Texas, and they are thrilled that UConn loses. Maybe not from a ratings perspective, but when you talk about can we win an NCAA title now, like, that door just swings wide.
The banner still hangs open, hangs in the rafters.
Exactly.
No matter who you beat.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't seen anything on that, and I'm sure maybe somebody has done that, and if not, we should, because I do feel like there's so much in the narrative of things and the conventional wisdom that does kind of say that, you know, you expend all of the effort and all of the focus that you have on this one particular opponent, and then it's almost like after that, there's nothing left. There isn't anything to kind of – you've almost climbed the hill that even though – you know, the championship is theoretically what you're playing for, that you've kind of accomplished your mission by pulling off this upset, and then, you know, there's nothing left to play for. Now, I think of, for instance, the 2004 Red Sox would have been a great example of a team that you might have, you know, thought that once they beat the Yankees and kind of came back from down 3-0, it would have been the perfect opportunity for that to kind of manifest itself. And instead, they just ended up kind of sweeping the Cardinals in the World Series. So you can think of, like, counterexamples too of that. And it would be interesting because something like ELO, for instance, the power rating system that we use at 538, would probably disagree with that. It would think that you would be more likely to pull future upsets or to win in the future
because you're a better team. If
you've learned, right? Exactly. Like the model has learned something about your quality by being able to pull off this big upset. It basically looks at it and says, "Look, if there's a rematch between Mississippi State and UConn the next day or whatever, Mississippi State would not be a 13% underdog. They'd probably be an underdog, you know, almost certainly, but they would be maybe like 25, 30, 35%, you know."
I wonder when it's a sport that determines its champions by a series, you would see this, if it's real, less frequently because you're talking about building for a moment and then turning around and building for a moment again, as opposed to settling in and being able. I know the Red Sox swept the Cardinals, but then you know that it's not another moment you have to live again. Even if you lose that first game, you're still like, right. Okay, we got six more games.
Yeah, it's not the focus all just sort of narrowed down to one particular game.
Okay, let's leave it there and move on to the men's tournament. Before we keep going with this week's show, let's get a word from one of our sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place is not enough to find quality candidates anymore. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all of the top job sites. And now with ZipRecruiter.com, you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office any longer. You can now quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And right now, Hot Takedown listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/takedown. That's ZipRecruiter.com/takedown. One more time, to try ZipRecruiter for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/takedown. 20 missed free throws, 44 total fouls. 34.8% field goal percentage. That was the game that was on display in the men's NCAA final on Monday night. Guys, a confession. I fell asleep during the second half. I woke up and the same game, like the same score was happening before I fell asleep. It was a really like a Twilight Zone experience. That was a poor game, I thought. But you know what? The UNC Tar Heels won whether it was a bad game or good game. As I said earlier, you hoist the banner, doesn't matter what happened to hoist it. Kate, as you sit and you look at UNC, from where I sit, it needs to be a two-year sort of sweep that we're looking at UNC, given last year's Villanova situation incident. Mm-hmm. Does this seem like a team that we're going to talk about in 5 years as, you know, typifying a certain era of college basketball? It just seems like, to me, a team that sort of happened and they won and that was that.
I mean, that's where they stand to me is, remember that North Carolina? Wow, it's like the day after. And I'm like, remember when they almost won back-to-back titles but so won that one really ugly title against the Zags? I mean, and that might be because my brain works in a way where I remember moments and I remember players. And certainly Meeks was great, and the Tar Heels have a lot of talent, but they don't have a transcendent player the way certain other championship teams have had. And the moment, if you're looking over the last 2 years, like the moment came on Villanova's end, overshadowing what would have been the Tar Heels' moment. And then last night, like, there wasn't a moment. There was just sort of like a lot of halting and screeching and kind of bumper cars happening.
So I want to get to the bumper cars, and I also want to talk about UNC's moments throughout the tournament because they did have some leading into this game. But let's talk about refereeing first, then I want to talk about UNC's sort of path to the title. Let's play a Colin Cowherd take before we keep going.
I am hearing everybody today, including NBA stars, say last night was bad basketball. The refs killed the game, and I will be the first to admit, the flow of the game was not great. Guess what, folks? That was not bad basketball. The referee's job is not to make sure you as a viewer enjoy the flow of the game. We've all been fooled into believing good basketball is 72 threes, an all-star game in the NBA that's 194-190. And last night was the opposite of that, and we don't know what to do.
Okay. Let's begin with this idea of good, bad basketball. Nah. If I may respond to the take with a lucid argument and something called logic.
Do.
Nothing about last night's game was bad because the score wasn't 190 to whatever else. One of the best games of the tournament was Gonzaga, West Virginia, which I think the score ended in the 50s.
Like
if 60s or 50s. So what made it bad basketball?
Don't build a straw man, Colin Cowherd.
What made it bad basketball was that it wasn't fun to watch. That it was disjointed, that it had the 40-something fouls, and that the shots were open shots weren't going in. Poor Shemek Karnowski, whose name I know how to pronounce now, had what, five gimmies right in front of the basket. The 3-point shooting for the Tar Heels has been bad for several games in a row.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me like we're allowed to call something bad basketball because it's not beautiful.
By what other metric would we have other than like shooting percentage? Like
they didn't make shots.
You know, I mean, like we've had conversations. I would love to pull like a Colin Cowherd take on like whether college basketball over the last 5 to 7 years has included bad basketball because of too many fouls. Because of poor shooting percentage that they have attempted to remedy, didn't seem so last night. But so you can't say that, like, look, we want to open up the game and create a better rhythm and create higher percentage shooting in whatever way we can manufacture that. And you can't say that that's bad basketball. And then when a single game is like a microcosm of all of that, well, because you want a contrarian opinion, like, now that's not bad basketball?
So, Neil, I have a question for you about bad officiating and whether there's whether stats can tell us when officiating is bad, because certainly this had the highest total of any of the last six final games, for example, of number of personal fouls. But games are played differently depending on who's playing them. So I'm not sure you really want to look at like the deviation from an average and just say, oh, they called too many fouls, that was that. Because games do have a different rhythm and different cadence depending on who's telling them. Right. And so like how do we try and evaluate a question that's being debated like this, which is, did the refs get in the way? And let's leave aside the out of bounds call that should have gone Gonzaga's way rather than the Gonzaga. Excuse me, I was corrected by people online
who
said it was Gonzaga. Gonzaga's way instead of the held ball that the jump ball that went to UNC at the end of the game. Sorry, long winded question. And my question for you: do we have a way where stats can tell us whether officiating was good or bad?
Yeah, plays like the play where, you know, it was unclear whether or not the out-of-bounds call was correct, that's not necessarily quantifiable, which is fine because we have, like, eyeballs and we can kind of go back. You know, one way that you can start to try to figure out, like, are too many fouls being called is you can look at, you know, controlling for how often each of these teams fouls and how often they shoot from certain locations that are more likely to draw fouls. You can try to figure out whether more fouls were called than we would expect, you know, based on the locations and the variety of different types
of
shots.
And those models already exist, or we would have to do the hard work?
I think we'd have to do the hard work ourselves at this point for college basketball. But it also, I don't think, would be that difficult to do if you had the data, which of course is kind of glossing over the main part, but
which is that we don't have the data.
That we don't have the data, or at least it's not, you know, necessarily at our fingertips at any given moment. But yeah, so you know that would be how you would do it. I can't say how it would come out for the teams last night, but I do think more fouls were called in this game than are typical for not only an NCAA championship game, but one that particularly features both of these teams, but maybe not as many more as you would expect, just because these were two teams that have, you know, they're both focused on interior, you know, the back and forth between these two massive front courts in general, and I think that played into it, but, you know, it was not an aesthetically pleasing ball game, and we know that these teams are capable of more aesthetically pleasing ball games also, so maybe that's also part of it.
They were both in the top 20 in offense in the country.
Yeah, exactly. And this was a game in which the winner, I think, averaged less than 1 point per possession, which is to say nothing of Gonzaga, who I think averaged 88.5 points per 100 possessions in the game, which was absolutely their lowest offensive output of the season, and we should say raw offensive output in a season that had one of the, you know, a very low strength of schedule. So they were not facing defensive, you know, juggernauts throughout the season, and in this particular one, when they went up against a better defensive team, they dropped off quite significantly offensively.
A misconception seems to exist about refereeing that like consistency is the goal, or like even-handedness. And the way I see refereeing is, like, I want them to be constantly a facilitator to the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just because for a couple minutes you felt the need as a refereeing crew to be like, look, we got to tighten it up. Things are getting out of hand. You know, let's make sure that we're getting this game back under our control. You don't need to do that for the whole game. Just like if you think you're calling too many fouls and you're like, look, we want to open up a good flow, You don't need to do that for the whole game. It's very easy and should happen where you bring teams together and you're like, look, we've been calling it tight. We're going to open the game back up. You just communicate about it. What was frustrating last night was watching was like, it felt as if the refereeing was like, well, this is the way we started calling this game. And so
right.
now we got
to
be
for
consistent.
One side. Now we have to do it for the
we
other side.
We have to be consistent. Yeah. Oh, and look, they each got 20. We each called 22 fouls on each of them. Like, that's
look
not
what a
the
great
definition
job we did.
of success. And then you're left with like a title game where I feel unsatisfied because I think North Carolina's a great team. I think they deserve to win, but like last night wasn't my evidence.
That's not exactly the way that you would have liked to have
yeah,
seen
like,
these both of the teams kind of put forth their best effort.
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of left discontent because you're like, I want to see two teams in a final moment like open up throttle and like see, even if it's like neck and neck, like who pushes past the finish line first, where instead it felt like we were, as I mentioned earlier, like kind of like jammed into a bumper car arena. Like, that's not satisfying.
Yeah, it was like kind of the feeling of being stuck in traffic and just like one, by the time there was like 5 or 6 minutes left in the game, it was just like, can we just get to the end of this thing already?
Yeah.
Which is definitely not the product that you want to put on national TV as your championship game. But it also sounds like, from what you're saying, Kate, and I agree with you, that this idea that Colin Cowherd said in the take that it's not the referee's job to make the game entertaining, that's kind of bullshit. I mean,
yeah.
It is one of the jobs, maybe not the primary job, but probably one of the big jobs of the referee is to facilitate a flow of play that is watchable
are
and enjoyable.
Are they not essentially an editor?
Right, they
you
are
know,
editing
I mean, like,
the game. They're between
the
two
game.
Teams.
Can you imagine like an editor in music being like, well, it's not my job to make sure like the product is
yeah,
smooth.
This is like
that's
a good sounding
song.
That's
actually the definition of your job.
So I have a question for you about UNC, which is they had a strange sort of journey in the sense that there were a lot of close calls in there. They barely beat Kentucky on a last second shot. The Oregon game came down to those offense rebounds that they got a couple of in the dying, waning moments of the game. And then this Gonzaga game, as we've discussed, maybe is not the best exemplar of their type of play. Does that change the accomplishment? That's what I'm trying to
get. The banner
understand.
Gets raised no matter what,
so,
Chad.
But
I
understand
think,
you're throwing my own words
yeah,
back at me.
Right,
but I do think, you know, we do end up – we have this economy of ranking champions that will later come down, right, where they'll be in the middle of the pack, let's say, or the – and back when some listicle gets put up online about the best NCAA champions of the last decade or of all time. But because of the – but at the same time, because of the nature of the NCAA tournament where someone's got to win – and crazy stuff happens. And Neil, you've written in the past about what is it called, the lone survivor paradox theory, something or other, about like in a Western, the central character that you have to have a central character that's somebody, and it seems
that
weird that person
up.
Never dies, but someone's got to never die in
right.
the Western.
I love the name lone survivor paradox.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what Wyatt Earp.
Wyatt Earp, yes, yeah. The Wyatt Earp.
I like. I prefer Tombstone.
Lone Gunman. Oh, Tombstone.
That's my favorite Western movie,
I enjoyed Tombstone Pizzas also.
You're my
frozen
Huckleberry,
pizzas growing up.
Which is relevant because Roy Williams looks
he
like
does
Huckleberry
look like
Hound.
Huckleberry Hound, yeah.
So we're back on track. To answer your actual question, Chad, though, like, I think there's a bit of like, to steal like a line from a movie, like a proximity infatuation with ranking champions. Like, because I can maybe hold like 3 to 4 NCAA champions and the moments of victory in my head and barely even that. Like right now, I'm really pulling mostly like Villanova last year. And I think we love because it's a great game and we have that final moment. It feels like they're the pure champion. So North Carolina for a couple of years might be like, man, they stumbled and bumbled their way to a title. But like, am I going to know in 15 years that the 2017 NCAA champion
right.
that we might feel that way about? Probably not.
But so, and this was interesting is that Villanova won its final game in a similar way that UNC won its Elite Eight game against Kentucky when mm-hmm. May hit that final second shot, right? And so here I am basically making the argument, oh, well, maybe that was such a close call means that they weren't such an incredible champion because it could have gone the other way so easily. Whereas what you're saying, Kate, is like, well, Villanova sticks out as like a crowning
moment.
Achievement. Yeah. But you could apply the same logic
totally.
And rationale.
Yeah, just because one happened in the national championship game versus the, you know, the Elite Eight or whatever, maybe that changes the legacy of a team. And yeah, it's not like so cut and dried, because I think another aspect of it is, you know, can we look at the talent on the particular roster? Like, for instance, people talk about the 1999 Duke team that didn't win the national championship still as one of the best college teams of all time because it had Elton Brand and Shane Battier and so on and so forth. And so I think that what these players end up going on to do plays a certain role also in it. And I think we're in like a weird place in general in college basketball, maybe since the start of the one and done era, where we've had, you know, a couple of UConn teams storm through that probably were not the best team in the country and won the national championship. We've had a Kentucky team that was undefeated throughout the whole season that didn't win the championship. They probably were the best team of 2015. And so you kind of have situations where it's always been the case in a one and done environment where there's 64 and now 68 teams. That you have to win six straight games in, that the best team doesn't win more often than it does win. But I think we might be in a place in college basketball now where that's even more the case, which is paradoxical, because before that you were getting you were getting like
lone survivor paradox theory.
No, you were, but you were getting preps to pros players from high school just bypassing college entirely, and people were saying this is sucking talent out of the college game. And one of the impetuses for putting the one and done rule in place was to actually have these, you know, singular star type players at least make a pit stop in college. Theoretically, that would raise the quality of play in college. But I'm not totally sure if we look back at the quality of teams, for instance, the Florida teams that won with Billy Donovan in the mid-2000s at kind of the tail end of the preps to pros slash beginning of the you know, one-and-done era, those were probably better teams than the teams that any of the teams that have won the championship in recent years in college basketball. Maybe that's not borne out by KenPom or whatever, but certainly those are more memorable, you know, cohesive teams. And maybe that's part of also me getting older. And
You like the nostalgia better.
Maybe there's nostalgia to it, too.
So you don't have proximity infatuation is what you're
telling me. It's anti-proximity.
So like an erosion of trust in that the infrastructure of the league, or in this case the sport, will actually reveal the champion.
A lot of that happening these days, too.
Erosion of trust, I know.
In institutions.
All right, let's leave it there. And we'll talk about college basketball again. Basically in like 10 or 11 months.
You want to make a bet about that, Chad?
Hiatus.
I actually know exactly when we'll start talking about it again.
I don't
like
think
in
we
November.
Did we do even like a Lonzo Ball segment this year? No, right?
We may have mentioned him once.
All right. And let's move on to...
Ooh, does the draft count as college basketball?
No, that's definitely not.
They're talking about players
no,
who played in
don't
college.
Try it.
So the NBA is talking about college basketball.
Right. Sort of.
Good segue, because it's time to talk about the NBA. Rest has been on people's minds in the NBA, not just because the season is far too long, not just because the playoffs are far too long, but because players are...
Though both of those are true.
Yes. Players are resting. LeBron James has rested several times this season already, before April even began. Golden State Warriors coach Steve Kerr kept out his core players in a primetime game against the Spurs. The Spurs, of course, are famous for resting players, or Spurs coach Greg Popovich is famous for resting players. And so there's been a lot of conversation from the league as well about whether this is an issue for the league as a whole. Adam Silver is saying this can't stand. They're likely going to be penalties coming down the pipe for teams who choose to do this. There's some question around whether it's about the amount of notice that teams give in advance so that fans will know and won't feel like they paid all this money to go see a team that is different than the team they paid for. And that broadcasters will also be able to say, oh, well, this is a March matchup with the Spurs and the Warriors. It's unlikely. It's less likely that the coaches are actually going to play everybody. But wanted to take this moment to talk about sort of the legacy of rest in the league. Kate, I'm curious, when do you feel like you first identified it beginning? And then we have some numbers that I want to run through with you.
So anecdotally, the first time I remember hearing about it was probably a couple years after the Spurs won the 99 title over the Knicks in the lockout year. Don't I remember that?
Everything's indexed
Latrell
by that
Sprewell
moment.
Because then a couple years after that would probably be when David Robinson was in need and, you know, a veteran who would have been on Popovich's list to do things differently and start resting. So That would be anecdotally to me.
But the Spurs stick out in your mind as
yeah,
the
like,
team that
maybe
started.
Like 03, 04, they start doing things a little differently. But before then, I don't ever remember watching, because I would watch all 82 games of all the Knicks throughout the night. I don't remember ever like tuning into like Clyde Frazier being like, well, John Starks is sitting tonight. He just needs some rest. Like, no.
So we ran a piece at 538 about players resting earlier and earlier in the season, which we'll talk about in a second. This guy Todd Whitehead scraped data from an injury transaction database. Only went back to 2006 for various reasons, so I'm not sure about the few years after.
I'm
99.
Probably right, though.
Absolutely. But Greg Popovich has sat players almost three times as many times as any other coach in the NBA. So 113 times since 2006. The next is Doc Rivers with 45. And in the last three seasons, it's triple Doc Rivers as well. And so, but what's interesting is that you see it spreading throughout the league. So Steve Kerr does it now. Tyronn Lue does it now. And obviously the players seem to be maybe asking for it now. And so, Neil, I'm curious if there's any evidence that rest actually makes people better or worse come the playoffs. Because LeBron seems convinced that there is, or at least that it doesn't hurt to try, basically. And it's certainly the case that when the Spurs beat James and the Heat at the time in the playoffs, James was hobbled with all sorts of cramps and all mm-hmm. sorts of other stuff. Now, was that because he played four extra games in a regular season?
Or was it because the air conditioning went off inside an American Airlines
arena? I
like the
conspiracy.
Yeah, I'm always in favor of conspiracies.
Erosion of trust.
Always.
Proximity infatuation.
I think that so the studies that have been done have been more along the lines of sort of like those biomechanical sort of like trying to track players' metrics in terms of a lot of things. So like, you know, how much sleep they're getting and how much, you know, kind of like raw output about their athletic, you know, performance rather than trying to pin it to basketball specifically. And I think it's because that's like the basketball question has so many different other moving parts that could also be attributed to, you know, things aside from rest. So I don't know that I've seen stuff about basketball specifically, you know, the effect of having rest versus not having rest being, you know, tied to your performance. But there's definitely a lot of research about there about how the workload of an NBA season is just an absurd amount of stress that it puts on your body. And I've banged this drum for a long time about how it's just not even necessary to play 82 games in a sport like basketball where we don't need them to determine who the best teams are. We can the analogy I've made in the past is that one NBA game is basically equivalent to one NFL game. So if 16 games is good enough for us in the NFL, and maybe we'd like it to be a little bit more in the NBA, but probably not that much more to kind of sort out the wheat from the chaff, if you will, then why do we need, you know, so many more times as many games in the NBA as we do in the NFL. And I think it comes down to, obviously, the owners don't want to give up revenue. They don't want to give up, you know, those precious home games that they can get. And also, you know, on top of that, the playoffs being as long as they are, that they're that way for a reason, too. But there's got to be some way. Maybe it's reducing the length of the game so it's not 48 minutes and you kind of keep the ticket sales the way they are, but you reduce the amount of wear and tear. But there just has to be some way to reduce this stress on the players while also managing the schedule the way they are. Or savvy teams are going to keep doing what they're doing. We're just now seeing everyone exploit this thing that was always exploitable and probably should have been exploited for a while.
I don't think that reducing minutes totally solves the problem. I think there is like the
wear because of travel and everything.
Yeah, and because I think we all know it's like if you have to go into work for 7 hours instead of eight, like does that seem like a day off to you? No, because there's something very refreshing in your mind about if you're Tim Duncan or, you know, he's still alive, but if you were Tim Duncan in the NBA being like, oh, I'm not playing tonight.
Yeah.
That's a very different thing that happens in your mind and your body. At least that's how I experience it when, like, I don't go to the gym for a day versus, like, oh, no, I'm going to run 2.7 miles instead of three today.
Right.
And then, but the money has to come from somewhere, meaning, like, it costs money to decrease the number of games. Except right now, it's not costing anybody money, and that's why, except maybe ESPN, right? Like, maybe it's costing ESPN because we paid a certain amount for a broadcast deal thinking that the Warriors-Spurs game in March was going to be a big deal, and then there are fewer viewers and therefore fewer ad sales.
And it was a big deal for the standings. That's what's so interesting is that this has started to creep into even when the games matter. And so it's both the trend has been that players are resting earlier and earlier, according to the data that we published at 538, but also that the high stakes games
still resting.
Yes.
And so I guess my point was, like, right now, who's bearing the burden, the financial burden of these players sitting? It does, and not that it's been played out yet, but it does seem to be like the broadcasters. Mm-hmm. And that can't continue if the NBA wants the next injection of the big contract. So then you're like, well, are the teams then going to knock down games? Probably not. So what's our other choices?
Something's got to give somewhere.
Because the NBA players realize, like, why would I play 82 games when I can play 70 and make the same amount of money? So is the answer that Adam Silver is like, here are the 20 games that you absolutely cannot
rest starters.
So that's my idea.
And then you get docked $25,000 to $100,000 if you do, and maybe that's where the money comes from?
So my idea is that we are fine with rationing teams certain number of timeouts, for example, during a game. Why can't we ration them a certain number of rests for their opening day roster or their top five win share players, however you want to do it, throughout the season? And that then it gives coaches and players, they know they have five rests for their top player in their pocket.
Right.
And they can choose, and injury obviously is separate, you have to figure out all these logistics, but they would choose when to deploy it.
But they can't choose. It's got to be like award travel, like there are blackout days.
Yes, absolutely right. But otherwise they're choosing when to deploy.
Yes.
I guess is my point.
Yeah.
And the blackout dates, I guess, would be against someone you played in the playoffs last season or a national
game. It would all be about national TV games.
But I think you still want to make sure that Curry and Kawhi play in a game, in a Spurs-Warriors game, even when it's not on national
TV. See, I don't think you care about that. I mean, because you're screwing over 15,000 people in arena versus, like, costing yourself $20 million down the line. I just think that you would totally focus on national TV games.
And I think those games are, for the most part, going to be on national TV anyway.
I mean, there's probably not a lot of separation there.
Yeah. The problem is, I mean, this is kind of a version of the tanking argument also is – and maybe this is coming up in the NBA more because it is such a deterministic league that we're now seeing teams try to, like, scrap and claw for all of the weird, like, edge cases of the rules and try to kind of bend and get around the you know, things that used to be sort of gentlemen's agreements where, you know, Patrick Ewing would play 82 games in a season and he wouldn't rest because that was sort of what you did and missing games was a sign of weakness or something like that. And the league has relied on these sort of unwritten rules that now they're realizing – if you don't write a rule, eventually the stakes are high enough for teams, mm-hmm. and there are enough teams that really want to kind of maximize whatever it is that they're trying to get out of the season that they're going to break the unwritten rules unless you actually write them. And even if you do write them and do ration out the DNP rests over a season, maybe if you use up your DNP rest early in the season, maybe you'll have a fake injury or something. You know, like there's nothing to stop teams, I think, you know, down the slippery slope mm-hmm. of just trying to scam their way to whatever marginal advantage they can get.
So it's all very interesting, Neil. It for some reason sparked this question in my mind, which is in baseball, there's all this talk of innings limits and resting pitchers so they don't eventually blow out their arms long term, etc. You don't hear this same kind of uproar about the business considerations and the fan attendance stuff around baseball for the top pitchers in the game. And I'm curious why that is.
Well, I think it's because of the fact that in baseball, one player doesn't make as much difference even if they are starting pitcher. I think it's also because even the best baseball team will lose to the worst baseball team a decent proportion of the time, enough that it's still interesting, you know, to watch. There's still uncertainty to it. Basketball, again, is like super deterministic. And if you take away LeBron, you know, from the Cavs, they suddenly have a drastically reduced chance of winning a game that you, as a broadcaster, hoped would be competitive. And so I think these are all problems we're running into because basketball is such a just weird, different sport than the rest of the sports we talk about.
Okay, let's leave it there and move on to our significant digit. Kate Fagan had to step out of the studio for this next segment, but it is time for our significant digit when a telling number from the world of sports is brought to us on a bronzed piece of oak. What do you think?
Wow.
Instead of a silver platter.
Interesting.
Bronzed piece of oak.
Okay.
Maybe like Kate gets a different title every week.
We have a different delivery mechanism.
Exactly.
For Sig Dig.
So tell me, Neil, what's on your bronzed piece of oak, which may be chemically impossible to do?
This is not what I was expecting the Sig Dig to be sitting on, but we'll just roll with it. So 16.5, that is the Sig Dig, and that is, of course, the number of at-bats per home run over the past three seasons and change for San Francisco Giants pitcher Madison Bumgarner. He had two home runs on opening day in two at-bats, and he has 14 home runs in 231 at-bats over the last, again, three seasons and change. And so if you kind of put that against all other players who have had at least 230 at-bats, including, you know, obviously batters, that ranks 16th in Major League Baseball over that span. It's ahead of Nolan Arenado, Josh Donaldson, Bryce Harper, Todd Frazier, Mark Trumbo. I could keep going, but you get the idea.
So 16 and a half at-bats.
Per home run.
That is like, it's really difficult to get one's head around because I don't know how often I do the optimal thing at anything in my life once every 16 and a half times I try and do it. You know what I mean? Like, especially as a non-professional, as someone who's not paid to do that thing as my
Well, the interesting thing is that his 16.5 at-bats come so much more infrequently than, say, Giancarlo Stanton, who does it every 13.6 at-bats, which is the most for anybody that has any kind of playing time over the past 3 years.
What do the sabermetrics say about how the Giants should use Bumgarner? Like, should he be a pinch hitter off the bench? Do we have a sense for how much an at-bat might wear him out on the pitching end? I mean, this seems as though the Giants are maybe underutilizing. Or on the flip side, is he only hitting these home runs because the pitchers are grooving them in there thinking, oh, it's just a pitcher, and so he's got more to swing at? Or on the flip side, has anyone run a pitch analysis of which kind of pitches Bumgarner is getting home runs on, and would he be easily figured out by pitchers if they even tried?
I don't know about any of that other stuff that's a little beyond the scope of Sig Dig. Maybe we can look at it this season. But I will say that they're probably not underutilizing Bumgarner as a hitter overall. So last season, for instance, he had a weighted runs created plus. That's the stat.
Work plus
that measures your effectiveness at producing runs where 100 is league average. And he had a work plus of 71. So he's 29% worse than the average hitter in baseball last year. And his career work plus is 54. Now, he had a couple really good years with the Giants in 14 and 15 when he had a 114 and a 105 work plus in back-to-back years. So if you've got a guy at all, much less a pitcher, that's putting up those kind of numbers, then by all means, that is an invitation to have them be a regular hitter. But the year before that, he had a minus 15. Work plus and had never broken 20 in a season. So certainly it seems clear that something changed about Bumgarner at the plate around about 2014 when he started this run of every home run every 16.5 at bats. Even though he hits that much, though, his career average is still only 187. He hit 186 last year. So it's kind of an interesting thing where, like, literally the only thing that he does seems to be to hit home runs or hit for power as a pitcher. He strikes out a ton, more than a third of his plate appearances. And it's not enough. He's not like a Micah Owings or someone like that, or one of the guys from like the 1950s, back when they actually did have guys who would pitch and then they would play in the outfield, you know, occasionally on days in which they weren't starting. That's not what we're looking at least here. And like you said, Chad, I would probably suspect that the more you know, book that people get on Madison Bumgarner, the more tape they can watch and analytics they can do, the less likely he would be able to hit home runs. But it is kind of wacky and cool and just bizarre to have a guy who's simultaneously one of the best pitchers on earth and also is hitting home run like one of the best power hitters on earth.
I have one last question for you.
Sure.
Has Sabermetrics studied whether or not pitchers throw different types or speeds of pitches to opposing pitchers? Which is to say, is there evidence that people are trying to take it easy, pitchers are trying to take it easy when they face their opponents, their opponent pitchers?
Well, I mean, I haven't seen numbers on it, but it is kind of, you know, long time coaching wisdom that you don't throw off speed pitches, you don't throw breaking balls to
they might hang
the other pitcher. Well, just because, like, why would you mess around with something that you might not have the best command over when you could just throw a fastball, which is presumably what you have the most command on, against a hitter that really isn't going to do that much damage to it? Now, by now, given Madison Bumgarner's home runs over the past few years, they probably have done a little bit of extra management for those at-bats than they would do against, you know, the generic pitcher. But I still think probably if we did look at it, he would see a higher proportion of fastballs than, say, the league average position player or something like that. And that's probably part of it. You know, part of the secret is that he can sit on a fastball and actually get around on it and send it somewhere, whereas the typical pitcher is useless no matter what.
Neil, I could talk to baseball about baseball with you all week.
It's almost like we have a separate baseball podcast.
Good segue. Small little announcement for Hot Takedown listeners who are Mets fans. Panic City, Neil and my spinoff pod, is back. You can find it in your favorite podcasting app. Neil, thanks for bringing that bronzed piece of oak.
Thank you.
Delightful digit on top of it.
Of course.
All right, that will do it for this week's show. Kate, you're back from departing us.
I'm back.
Just in time to say goodbye.
You're welcome.
Thanks for talking about sports.
Thank you.
Neil Payne, always a pleasure.
Of course, Chad. I play 82 games for no good reason.
I play 90 just because I can.
Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. Our podcast pinch hitter is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow. A UNC Tar Heel fan. Tony's so happy today. Great to see Tony happy.
He should be ashamed of the game that was played.
Oof.
Ouch.
And Jorge Estrada. I'm not sure Jorge's college basketball allegiance.
I think it's Wisconsin.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcasting app. We're on iTunes, of course, as well. iTunes.com/vibe. 538, while you're there, be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. We already mentioned Panic City, Neil. We don't have to do it again. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.